About 55 years ago, this man was a young solicitor in a fancy law firm where I was an articles clerk. Me at the bottom of the heap, he already climbing the ladder that would lead to London, Doughty Street Chambers, fame, silk, and many, many books. I could see where he was going, and I thought I'd leave him to it, so I'm not the least bit jealous. Geoffrey Robertson, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello again, David.
After all this time. To discuss... It's your 17th book, isn't it?
No, my 24th.
Oh, I'm sorry. I begin with an error.
We cut a few out because they couldn't fit in the page.
Of course, of course. And this one is entitled World of War Crimes, Eyeless in Gaza and Beyond. Now, Geoffrey, you are the master of the hypothetical. Let me put to you something that is actually not hypothetical. On September the 2nd, the United States destroyed a speedboat thought to be ferrying drugs across the Caribbean, leaving two survivors in the water. According to two witnesses who've spoken to the Washington Post, the United States Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, ordered, kill them all, and they were killed. Has a war crime been committed here?
Definitely. Probably two. The first being the shooting up and killing of most of the crew of the boat, according to a belief, not a determination, that they might have had drugs. It's not... The death penalty is not imposed on those who have drugs in the United States, but here it was imposed on those who were thought, not by any means proved, to be bringing drugs into the United States. However, what is even worse and horrific is that the survivors, two survivors clearly seen in the water, were then killed. The question is who gave the order to kill, whether it was the admiral, who was thereby committing one of the most serious war crimes a naval officer could commit, or whether it was Trump, who had indicated that he wanted them all dead, or whether it was some version of that determination by Pete Hegseth. But one way or the other, a war crime it certainly was, a fundamental war crime. Every sailor, every admiral knows that you're not allowed to shoot survivors of a shipwreck. It's absolutely clear from the very first. From there was a case in 1918, Landovery Castle, full of Canadian nurses, which was sunk by a German U-boat, and they then surfaced and machine-gunned the survivors, the nurses and the sailors who had survived the sinking. And even a German court condemned them for that war crime. And so that's always used as an example that survivors must not be killed. And Geoffrey, they were.
Geoffrey, you make the point in the book that the decent treatment of the survivors of war, not only at sea but also on land, is one of the laws of war that on the whole is respected. Yours is a lucid but grim account of the disobedience of the so-called laws of war. But this one matters, really. And there's an interesting link with Lincoln, with Abraham Lincoln, who, I didn't know about this until reading your book, who offered the South the promise that if they surrendered, they would be decently treated. And that this is a key step in the formation of international rules of war.
That's right. It's Lincoln's Code, which really was adopted as late as 1949 by the Geneva Convention. So it was a vital point. But what the present problem poses for the Australian military, we may have to fight alongside the Americans. We may be led by the Americans. Who knows? Taiwan could be invaded next year. And we have to decide just whether we're going to accept American control, which is devoid of any respect for the law of war, to which our troops are sworn. Not that they always comply.
Yes, but the decent treatment of prisoners is at the heart of the case being made against Ben Robert Smith.
Mm.
And made against him by his fellow soldiers.
It's interesting, isn't it, that it's very often today not the prosecutors, not the commanders who take action. It's fellow soldiers, decent soldiers, who give evidence against commanding officers who order war crimes. That was the case when you and I remember William Kelly,
yep,
the guy who ordered waste them in relation to the villages of My Lai. And today we have one particular soldier who was convicted 10 years ago for a rather dreadful murder in Afghanistan. He was given, the evidence against him was given by his troops, and he was given 20 years in prison. But then one Pete Hegseth, who was working, I think, at the time for Fox News, decided that he was a hero rather than a criminal. His name was Clint Lawrence. And he persuaded President Trump in 2019 at his retirement awards of pardons to pardon him. And Trump said he's a war hero, not a war criminal.
Yep.
On the contrary, he was the latest version of William Kelly.
And of course, while we're talking Trump, didn't he not the other day say that some commentators, amongst them senators, who said the completely unremarkable proposition that soldiers are not to obey illegal orders, that such people should themselves be put to death?
Yes, he did. And of course, it's fundamental in war crimes law that you do not need to obey, indeed you should not, an obviously illegal order. That was indeed the the ruling in the case I mentioned, the Landovery Castle, where the guys who manned the guns and shot the struck nurses as they were struggling in the water said, well, we were ordered to do it by the commander of the U-boat, to which the court, even a German court, said obeying obviously illegal orders is no defence, and that has been upheld in Nuremberg and ever after, until Trump, who appears to take the view that might is right, that killing the enemy is all very well so long as it's the enemy, and that centuries of war crimes law can be discarded.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Geoffrey Robertson about his new book that reaches a lucid, as I say, but grim conclusion. Let me read this sentence. The law of war, Geoffrey writes, is a delusion designed by great powers and their servant lawyers and diplomats so that it will never hinder their military ambitions. Geoffrey, that is an astonishingly bleak conclusion.
I don't know that it's bleak. It's true. I mean, I wrote this book because of a year watching children being dug out of rubble in Gaza and in Ukraine and in Sudan. And these were horrific war crimes. And yet you have an expert put in front of the camera saying, oh, this may be a war crime. Maybe. Yes, indeed, because there is so much wriggle room that's been left so by the major powers who've fashioned war law so that their own troops will by and large not fall foul of it. The problem I trace back to Goering, as you might have seen the current film of Goering at Nuremberg. Why on earth wasn't Goering prosecuted for the Blitz, which he commanded?
Now, why was the Blitz a crime?
Well, exactly, because the rules made in The Hague in as early as 1923 had said you can't bomb for terrorist, you can't engage in terror bombing of civilians. And that was precisely what the Nazis did, directed by Goering. And here he was sitting in the dock at Nuremberg, and he wasn't prosecuted. Why? If you look at the secret memoranda and so on, because they were afraid that he would run the "you did it too" defense, tu quoque in Latin, "I did it, but you did it too." And we did in, of course, Dresden and in Tokyo, 100,000 burnt to death. That was hidden. So we never had a law, a precedent for prosecuting the indiscriminate bombing of cities. And that's why many pictures of residential areas with windows blown out and people being dragged out of rubble, dead bodies.
Children. That's
children, of course, because there is no clear law against it. There should have been. Goering should have been prosecuted, as should Netanyahu, as should Putin, for the use of indiscriminate bombing against civilians who are not children, women, old men, who are in no way useful militarily. But that is not the law. None of the bombers are going to be prosecuted. Indeed, Trump, the great appeaser, has devised this plan with his friend and fellow property developer Steve Witkoff, or Dumbkopf as he's widely known, which gives an amnesty to Putin and to everyone else as a key part of the so-called peace plan for Ukraine.
Nothing there in the peace plan to suggest there will be crime, that there will be war crimes trials.
On the contrary, the amnesty precludes them.
Yep.
So there will be no war crimes trials, nothing in the agreement in Gaza to suggest war crimes trials. Zomi Frankum, our own martyr in a sense, died in vain. The people who ordered that obviously negligent and grossly negligent strike will be allowed to sleep easy in their retirement. So that is what we face today, the great appeaser, Donald Trump, who will not, in fact, a complete lack of morality. If any moral view of the war in Ukraine says that Putin started it, but that's not a judgment that will enter into calculations.
Shall we get there by having a look at the shortcomings that you point out in a number of the bodies, the conventions, the courts that are supposed to punish crimes of war? Let's start with the Security Council. I have never read such a not only persuasive but full bore attack on the Security Council. Cannot be saved, you say.
It's worthless. It has five permanent members, each with a veto. And those who use the veto most are Russia, of course, whenever anyone suggests truce in Ukraine. America, whenever it suggested that Gaza might have a ceasefire. And, of course, if China were to invade Taiwan, which it may do next year, because it should do it before Trump leaves, so that it has the benefit of his turning a blind eye, it will veto any criticism by the United Nations of his attack on democratic, peaceful Taiwan.
Do you think that has been a cause of war in the decades since the setting up of the UN, the veto power?
Yes, I think it has. It's certainly been used and rather more threatened. It's the threat of a veto behind the scenes that stops a lot of worthwhile action that the Security Council could take. It can set up courts, it can put blue helmets into situations of conflict, it can do a lot of things, but the threat of a veto stops it. And anything that would discomfort either America, Russia, or China, or indeed their allies. Nothing was done about Syria for all its use of chemical weapons because Russia was preventing it and threatened a veto behind the scenes.
You make the point that only the friendless can be brought to justice.
Colonel Gaddafi was in that category almost uniquely because he just flailed around and insulted everyone, and no one had any sympathy for him. So his was the only case where the Security Council voted unanimously to stop him by force.
Now let's go down through the organisations. The International Criminal Court, ICC, looks wonderful. There are some problems there.
Until you realise that it has no power over countries that don't sign up to it.
Who hasn't signed up?
Who do you think?
Maybe Russia, the United States of America?
Russia, China and the USA. And Israel, of course. But Israel was caught because once Palestine was recognised as a potential state, it became capable of getting the ICC involved in war crimes in its territory. And so the ICC has been able to indict Netanyahu for starvation as a tactic of war, which is a war crime, and for bombing and droning irresponsibly, or certainly for bombing areas, residential areas of cities, in the knowledge that civilians would be killed.
But, Jeffrey, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, has no power to try anybody unless they turn up and face
right.
trial.
That's right.
And I don't know, maybe I'm misreading Netanyahu, but I don't think he will.
Well, he's got to weigh what people will say long after he's dead, that here was a court that followed on from Nuremberg, which was set up to expose and to put right the appalling tragedy, the genocide of the Jews in Europe. And the leader now of Israel dodges that court and refuses to make a defence. Of course, he's got an arguable defence, and he should make it. And if he doesn't, he will go down as a coward and as a, perhaps in some view, the betrayer of the history of his people. But nonetheless, it is, I think, a start that he has at least been indicted and invited to defend his actions. And many would think they are defensible, but let us see what his defense is. Essentially, what Israel says is, oh, we didn't commit genocide because we were really only concerned to kill Hamas people.
Well, politicize
rather than genocide.
Let's go to that question, because it's one of the points that you argue in the book, that there's a problem even with the definition of genocide, that it's not clear what groups you are allowed to kill
yes,
without facing penalty. So Pol Pot.
Classic example. We all
not genocide.
We all saw The Killing Fields, Roland Jaffe's film that exposed the horrors in Cambodia, and the UN rushed in, a genocide court, genocide charges, and then some lawyers said, "Wait a minute, genocide means the killing or the persecuting of people for their race or their religion." And the victims of the Khmer Rouge were in fact killed on for a political theory, a crazed political theory, and not because of their race or religion. So the charges had to be dropped. But my point is that the killing of any people because of their legal rights, whether to worship a particular religion, whether to the fact that they're of a particular race, or whether they have a particular form of politics, whether they're Marxists or whatever, should all be covered by this crime of killing the generality of people. So that is one problem. Another problem with genocide is that you've got to prove a genocidal intent, and you've got to prove it very strictly, and sometimes you can't. You've got to infer a genocidal purpose from the statements made by leaders.
Which has been done in the case of Gaza.
The South Africans brought a case in the International Court of Justice in which they led off. Some of them were from my chambers, I'm proud to say. They led off with quotes from the president and from other commanders about or likening the Palestinians to animals who had for that reason to be put down. So, yes, there is an important decision on what constitutes genocide. It should be next year, but I'm afraid it may be not until 2027.
Jeffrey, there is so much to discuss and so little time. I mean, one of the revelations to me in your book is that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, can be stopped in its tracks by the Security Council. The Security Council can just tell it to stop.
Yep.
But it would have to be a unanimous decision of the Council, would it not?
Yes, I think that's true.
But
even
it
hasn't been tested.
And look, there is the extraordinary position of the Red Cross that knows so much but can say nothing about war crimes. Also beautifully set out, grimly set out in your book, the failure to make aggression a crime, an international crime, that there's wiggle room everywhere. I want to get to a couple of things while we have a moment. Firstly, what did you learn about the subject of war crimes as president of the UN Court in Sierra Leone?
Well, it was a struggle, but I think we succeeded on the whole to bring war crimes home to a number of those most responsible, the leaders of the factions that killed each other. Operation No Living Thing lived down to its name with the group that produced it and killed. And indeed, they had different war crimes. There was a UN supervised election, which this faction didn't like, and it went round afterwards saying to people, "What hand did you held the pen on which you voted?" And they chopped it off. So chopping became a new war crime. There was also forced marriages, people being forced to marry leaders at the end of a gun. And there was the recruitment of children into frontline service that we established as a war crime, the first time that it was established as a war crime. So there was some pioneering work we did, but it was hard because in Nuremberg, Robert Jackson, the prosecutor, said we succeeded because of the Teutonic habit of writing everything down.
Oh, yes, keeping perfect records of what they did.
Yes, there they were.
But not in Sierra Leone, I suspect.
On the night and fog decrees all had Goering's signature. But in Sierra Leone, there was nothing. And except mass graves, which we had to go and find.
Were people punished as a result of your work?
Yes, yes. There's Charles Taylor is still in prison in England.
Excellent.
In the north, now, freezing in the north of England. He's there for life.
Now, Geoffrey, I have assigned about a minute and a half to your explanation of how all this might be solved by the democratic nations coming together to establish a completely new order. What are the chances of this?
Well, what else can there be? I think that the prospect of a third world war is likely to concentrate minds. It always does. But for a start, we've got to accept there is no protection for democracy in the UN Charter. It's not mentioned. Half the people of the world live under authoritarian rule. The Security Council is worthless. It's permanently deadlocked. And so it's up to democracies to step up to the plate and to sort out their own. I go back to a dear old H.G. Wells, who said when the League of Nations collapsed in 1939, he said, we've got to replace it by parliamentary peoples, by which he meant democracies. And this is a possibility if democracies get hold of the idea, if they realize, and as democracies can be pushed over, look at Ukraine, look at Burma, Myanmar, and many other democracies can be overpressed. But if the Commonwealth of Nations, which has 56 members, and the European Nations, which has 40 members, maybe exclude Hungary, but they are very influential, even without the United States. They have enough soft power. So I think that is one way of altering the power structure and enabling, I suppose, democracies to protect themselves, whether they will or not, remains to be seen. As for Russia, well, we have the possibility of soft power, of banning Russians, or at least those who won't sign up to condemning their country for invading Ukraine. They shouldn't be allowed in. They should be expelled. We should, in Australia, declare as persona non grata all the Russian diplomats who spend their days drinking vodka and reading papers so they can impose sanctions
on
Australians.
Can I point out to you what you're doing here? You are arguing for the tougher imposition, for the tougher exercise of soft power.
Yes, yes. That's right. Yes. Harder soft power.
Harder soft power. Look, on that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop for the time being, though this is a discussion that is going to continue for some time as Geoffrey's latest book, World of War Crimes, takes hold in the market. Geoffrey, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live. There is so much more to talk about, but it is an extraordinarily chilling and, at the same time, inspiring book. Thanks for it. And thanks for coming
very much,
on Late
David.
Night Live.
Pleasure.